We hear the Ten Commandments today, and I've mentioned to a couple of folks that every preacher at some point in their preaching takes on the Ten Commandments, and they usually do it. We usually do it one of two ways, neither of which we're usually very happy with. Either we try to do them all at once, and that sermon lasts, you know, like an hour and a half. And it's just, even if you try to do an acrostic of the Ten Commandments, it takes a long time because there's so much to say. Or we take them one at a time, and you do a series on the Ten Commandments. So there's 10 of them, right? So that's 2.5 months of Ten Commandments, one after another after another. And even we get tired of it halfway through. So this is the way preachers usually do it. Well, the Ten Commandments come today, and I thought, well, let's just go to the last one and see what happens. And so here we are. You better not be coveting, because if you are, you're going to hear it today. Before we get to the last one, we begin with the first one. We see the Ten Commandments open with, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. The Ten Commandments end with the command to not covet other people's stuff. To really live the first one, you shall have no other gods before me, which seems vitally important, we need to live the last one, which sometimes gets overlooked. And as different as these two sound, they both, in speaking to the desires of the human heart, create a people whose love of God and love of neighbor are made pure. To receive the gift of the tenth commandment, a working definition of covet would probably be helpful. Unlike some of the other commandments, which are clearer, covet eludes a precise definition. And that's partly because the word in Hebrew, chamad, isn't entirely always objectively a bad thing. In Hebrew, it can mean delight or pleasure, and delight is often a wonderful thing to be nurtured, not a bad thing to be avoided. But sometimes in the Old Testament, chamad does mean something dangerous. It's the gleam in Eve's eye in the garden when she looks at the forbidden tree and desires its fruit for the first time. There's that same word. And so we see that even if we can't have a precise, helpful definition, how do we measure such a thing as desire to know whether it's okay or not? It's not like the other verses. If we can agree on the word adultery, we kind of know what it means when adultery's been committed. If we can agree on the word murder, we pretty much know what that means when it's happened. And that's not to say there aren't challenges with each of these. Adultery, murder, Sabbath keeping. Centuries of study and reflection on these words produce long lists of laws intended to clarify the core commands. Hundreds of Jewish laws were created to help people know what it means to honor the Sabbath, for example. People of faith have worked diligently and thoughtfully for centuries to understand how to live out these commands. It's silly, the thought that you can nail the Ten Commandments to a courthouse wall and solve anything. These commands are an invitation to a way of life in relationship with God, not just rules to be imposed. This last one, the one about coveting, is a really good example of this. On first glance, it sounds pretty straightforward. The cowboy version simply says, don't be hankering for your buddy's stuff. And that's not a bad start. But what does that mean? What does hankering mean? How do I know when I've gone from appreciating and liking something to wanting that thing to hankering for it in a way that would violate the Tenth Commandment? That shows how challenging this is. You can see stealing. You can see adultery. You can see or hear bearing false witness. You can't see or measure hankering. The other commandments are about external actions, but what is the outward manifestation of coveting? How do you know if you're doing it? This is especially challenging in a culture like ours that is saturated with messages designed to fan the flame of desire. You can hardly get away from the commercials calculated to cause us to desire what we didn't even know we needed or wanted until we saw it. The engine of our economy is consumer spending. consumer spending in an era of easy credit is less a function of how much we have to spend and more a measure of how much we're willing to spend on what we're made to desire. Dave Ramsey puts our predicament really well, saying, we buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. We're a mess, aren't we? Changing the economic system, if such a thing were possible, wouldn't solve the problem. Stanley Hauerwas quips, the socialist calls capitalism legalized greed, and the capitalist calls socialism legalized envy, and both have truth in what they say. Social systems based upon schemes for organizing people like us will inevitably be institutionalized resistance to the commandment against coveting. A working definition of coveting is disordered desire. It's not only when you want the wrong thing. It's when you want the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. And even when you want the right thing for the wrong reasons. Or even when you want something that's neither right nor wrong in itself, but you want it in the wrong way. That's when you've gone to hankering. For them back then, it was a disordered desire apparently for a neighbor's house, wife, servants, ox, donkey, or anything else. For us, it's probably not so different. Disordered desire for our neighbor's house, family life, or family, job, status, car, or anything else. The "or anything else" means the soul searching we're called to do is endless. There's no specific limit to what's included here. Do not covet your neighbor's anything. Do not have disordered desire in your heart. But what does that mean? Is there such a thing as rightly ordered desire? Is that okay? The Christian tradition is skeptical of even this, knowing how our hearts are vulnerable to disorder. We're taught as Christians to be detached from our desires and our possessions. So we're not just detached from what someone else has. We're detached even from what I already have. Do not covet even your own stuff. Be willing to even let that go. It's when you can say with the Apostle Paul, I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. I appreciate one little word in particular in the Apostles' Confession. Learned. I have learned. Detached contentment didn't come naturally to such a competitive-driven person as he was. For Paul, I don't think it was creature comforts that drove him, but it seemed to be the desire to win, to control, to destroy his opposition. That's woven into Paul's personality. And so, what a testimony that he's able to give witness to the good work of God in him, that his joy and identity isn't from what he's accomplished or consumed or achieved, but in trust in whatever circumstances. His eyes are set higher, and so life becomes simpler and love for God purer. He can say, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think on these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. The fruit of this is the contentment that we have, that we learn in whatever life brings our way. But this is hard, truly. Coveting is not a way of life we opt into by willful disobedience. in our culture especially, coveting is a way of life. You have to willfully resist. Disordered desire, lust, envy, greed, consumption, believing that true happiness is elusive unless you can have that one more thing. This is who we're made to be. It's all around us. It's within us. Unless you are truly attending in prayer and humility to the 10th commandment and the way of Jesus, it will become part of your life and then take it over. Again, from Hauerwas, here in the last command, we discover what all the commandments are about. Namely, that we were created to love God. And when that love is misdirected, life degenerates into a jumble of disordered desires, fragments testifying that we were meant to be something quite else than what we have become. I'm aware of some folks, perfectly nice folks that come to mind, who are all but defined by their desires. There's always a next thing to buy, always one more thing to consume. Satisfaction in what they already have is fleeting. It's always the next thing on their minds. You get the sense after a while that it's not the actual consumption of the things that brings them happiness, but the accommodation of desire. It's the actual desire, the thrill of the desire, that is the desire. And so what they've come to love is not joy, not enjoyment in the things or the things themselves, but desire itself. Desire is not just a part of their lives, it is their lives. And the thing is, I could either be talking about specific people I know, or I could be given confession of our own lives, or I could be talking about any of us. This story is true about our whole way of life, whether we're rich or poor or have a lot or little. We are absolutely tempted all the time to let desire be the fuel in our engines. Rich Mullins wrote, "Everybody I know says they need just one thing, and what they really mean is they need just one thing more." Joan Chittister tells a story that's helpful here. The story tells of an exhausted American businessman who traveled to a faraway island for a dream vacation. Every day he went to the beach to swim, and every day he watched a local native man there slowly cleaning fish on his little boat. After studying him for a few days, the businessman swam over and asked him, "Do you catch fish every day?" "Oh, yes," the local said. "There's plenty of fish here." The visitor asked, "How often do you fish?" "I fish every morning." "But what do you do the rest of the day?" the businessman asked, thinking how different this man's life was from his full days back home from morning to night working at the office and beginning to smell a business opportunity. "Well," the man said, thinking about the odd question, "first I clean the fish for supper, then I take a little siesta, then I build a bit on my house, then I eat with my family, and then for the rest of the night I play my guitar, visit with my friends, and drink my homemade wine." "Wow," the businessman's eyes gleamed. "Don't you see, if you fished all day, you could sell your fish, build a bigger boat, hire helpers, can, pack, and sell your fish all over the world and make a lot of money." "What would I do with it?" "Well," the businessman said, thinking about the odd question, "you could buy a house, quit working, enjoy your family, take big vacations, party with your friends the rest of your life." "Well, mister, that sounds like what I'm doing now, and I only have to catch one fish a day." Spiritual wisdom is you don't have to have everything to have everything you need. The sacred word against coveting, the final word in the Ten Commandments, is keen insight into the core brokenness of human nature. Our desires are not only disordered, we don't even know what rightly ordered desires hardly are anymore, at least without a lot of help. And that's the wisdom of the commandments, seen through this lens. They are just the kind of help we need, as we see now the wisdom of coveting as the last commandment that is measured by all the others. If your desire leads you to tell a lie to get it, if your desire leads you to steal or toward adultery or to murder, it is disordered desire. If your desire makes you dishonor those who've made life possible for you, your fathers and your mothers. If your desires do not allow you to honor time for God and rest for those around you. If your desires use the name of God like a mascot or a slogan. If your desires lead your eyes away to shiny things before which you bow down your life. If your desires put anything else, including yourself, before God, whom you are not, your desires are disordered, and you are being called back to the holy love of God. This is entirely a gift of grace that God has given to us, a language that helps us attend to our innermost, even hidden motivations. The temptation always is not to love God and neighbor, but to love ourselves and to use God and neighbor to love ourselves even more. And so we pray for God's help in the secret, inmost heart, that God would search our hearts and lead us in the way everlasting, the way of righteousness and freedom and peace and pure love for one another and for our God. For his sake and for the sake of the gospel. Amen.